And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels. It is Monday, December 6th. Derek Van Riper here with Eno Saris. On this episode, we have a lot to talk about, even though the lockout rages on. We're closing in on the first week of the great lockout of 2021. But we are going to talk about a huge story that broke last week. We teased this on the pod last Wednesday. Bradford William Davis had a story at Business Insider about massive differences in the baseballs used throughout the 2021 season. So we'll talk about the implications of that. Going to dig into some related home run rate surprises and figure out what to do with those players going forward. Eno's got an ISO barrel rate concoction to pass along, so we're going to look into that and try and figure out if there's
a hidden source of value there.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was trying to do. I wanted to make it sound like either a sandwich or a nice adult beverage, so I feel like I successfully did that. And we've got a few more early draft observations as well. Eno's been doing an auto new mock. I had the XFL auction over the weekend, not the old football league run by Vince McMahon, but a longstanding keeper league that was created by Ron Chandler about 20 or so years ago now. So that actually happened on Saturday. We'll talk about some stuff that came from that and the other early drafts that we've done as well. But I think we do need to start with the baseball, because Craig Calcaterra, as he tweeted this morning, pointed this out. This is a bigger story than the amount of attention it's received so far. And I think this is interesting because we've talked about the ball, I think, almost as long as this podcast has existed, right? We've started the show back in the spring of 2019, and the baseball
that
has been
the peak home run year with the craziest baseball.
Yeah, the baseball's been under the microscope that entire time. Dr. Meredith Wills has been slicing open baseballs for that period of time, plus a few years prior to that. It was her findings that were a big part of the story that Bradford wrote. This is different, though, because what was reported here is that there's not this isn't just random variation in production. These are separate batches of baseballs with heavier and lighter cores. And the concerning thing is that the core was supposed to be changed, and yet the timestamps on the ball, the manufacturing stamps on the ball, prove that the changes didn't actually happen the way they were supposed to happen. So that leads to a lot of questions. Plenty of people quoted in the story and around the game are saying, well, what the hell? Like, could Major League Baseball have been sending baseballs to specific places for specific reasons? There's currently no evidence of that, but it's just opened the floodgates for even greater mistrust between the Players Association and the league, given that, you know, as we've said on the show before, the league has a major stake in Rawlings. They have more control over this process than they've ever had before, and yet here we are with further evidence that there are some massive problems with the consistency of the ball.
Yeah, and the league tried to kind of throw Rawlings under the bus again. It's kind of what they do. you know, when we found out that there was a new ball, that they were going to change that core, they said, Rawlings was going to, put those out there. We said, no, we got to hold on to those and test those for a year. You know, that was the whole idea, that they were going to test these new balls and they weren't going to use them right away. And then in 2021, they were supposed to use them, but instead they used some old ones too. They threw Rawlings on the bus and basically said, because of COVID, they didn't have a full factory. Because they couldn't do full production, we sent some old balls out there. Now, we all had to figure stuff out during COVID. Supply chain issues are still out there. There's still an uneasy agreement between supply and demand, is how I'd put it. and large jumps in demand for certain things. I think that's part of why the production cycle has been arrested, like the sort of the relationship is not at ease, because, you know, we went from wanting industrial work toilet paper to wanting only home toilet paper, right? And the problem wasn't that there weren't wasn't enough toilet paper. It was that nobody wanted those big rings of toilet paper anymore because they weren't pooping at work anymore. So that's why. It's not like we pooped more during COVID. That would be weird.
I didn't expect you to choose anything else for your supply chain related, like day-to-day product changes, but I like how your mind went there, and mine was Clorox wipes, because if you wanted bleach wipes,
God, you know,
last year,
those, yeah,
they were impossible to find for a while, and you know, we learned, oh, well, actually, the demand for them, of course, that was pretty obvious, was never this high because a lot of people were at work, and yeah, cleaning supplies at work or cleaning crews at work took care of it.
But in this case, it was a little bit more. I think this also is part of the supply chain crisis, is that there's like a different relationship between work. You know, people are sort of reevaluating their relationship between their home and life balance and their, what they're willing to do for work. Because I think at some point there was a question: am I willing to sort of put myself at risk health wise to make money, right? There's like a lot of jobs, a lot of service jobs now that are having a hard time getting filled because A, they pay like crap, and then B, you're on sort of on the front line of just like seeing people inside, you know, during a pandemic. So, you know, in this case, they said they didn't have enough people at the factory to hand sew these balls, and so they had to use old ones. It's a great story. It might be true. The problem is that they haven't really been see-through about this from the beginning. You know, I think all the way back to when Rob Manfred said that, you know, that the reason that home runs were up in 2015 was because they were putting power hitters at the top of lineups now. So, you know, kind of this could go right into that where it's like, it sounds, like an interesting, story, and it could be true. The kind of missing piece of reporting, as I see it, is, is union leadership, basically saying whether or not they were told. Because we do in Bradford's story, which is great, we do have player reps who didn't know, but maybe it was told to some union leadership and didn't get down to all the players, you know. So there's some question there of what happened there. If they did not tell the players, then I think it's a fairly big crisis. It's like a crisis of confidence in the commissioner to do his job and to be, you know, to be, what's it called?
Transparent.
That's it. That's the word I was looking for. I was like, see-through, but it's not see-through. That'd be weird.
Ding, 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 ding. Yeah, it's like being on a game show sometimes.
But being transparent. And if he's not going to be transparent, then he's going to fall into the bucket of the Japanese commissioner that changed the ball without telling anybody and then had to resign.
I never knew about that until I read this story. So that was among the things I learned here. I didn't realize there was that much of a scandal in Japan with baseballs previously that cost the commissioner his job. Now, I don't think we'll be that lucky here. If I had to guess, as you might,
but
you
know, assume. Does have potential. I think that's the other thing that's really interesting about this. This does have potential impacts on the CBA talks. And on the ownership side, you know, you're looking at your guy and you're saying, did you send me the dead balls, Manfred? You know, there's a story out there that someone did some research and was like, the Yankees got sent some dead balls, they think. It's like, you know, I don't want to vouch for that story and say that's necessarily true, but that's the type of thinking that that could lead to a little bit of like, hey, Manfred, why'd you send me the dead balls?
Right. Yeah, if it is
found... Oh, you hate the Yankees, huh?
If it is found that specific batches were sent to specific teams and specific series even for a reason, like that's... I mean, this is a problem
and
regardless.
That's the major sort of question mark on top of all this. And mm-hmm. And also, I think, you know, if people are frustrated that there's no... follow-up coverage yet, I mean... partially follow-up coverage takes a while. You know, you're supposed to, if you're reporting on a story, like have something new to advance it, right? In terms of writing a story. Now, if you're going to aggregate it, then of course you can write about it. But I think people are looking at this and trying to find the way to advance the story, as opposed to like The Athletic is never going to just be like, you know, here's the story from Bradford, as amazing as it is, you know, like if you're not going to advance it, then you're not going to really write about it. So that's just the my perspective on this, that I'm looking for a way to advance the story to write about this further. But, you know, Meredith and Bradford did a really good job. And I think it is a really interesting. So to me, the two aspects that are the most interesting are, you know, whether the union knew about it, what this means for the labor negotiations, and so on.
And I think it leads to questions
and then player questions.
Yeah, for us, like in terms of what happened to these guys, you know, whose performances were perhaps most impacted by the highly variable baseballs that were in play. And I think there's a few ways to go about this. The home run rate is really noisy year to year anyway. I think it is becoming...
For pitchers.
Yeah, for pitchers, it's become a lot less important in how I look
actually
at a profile.
Hitters too. That's why we have barrels, right?
Yeah. But I just think it's one of those stats that used to be, like 10-ish years ago when I was looking at a pitcher, it was K rate, walk rate, home run rate. And that was kind of, for me, a complete portrait of a pitcher. And I think the weight of home run rate, if I were still only using those three things right now, is a lot less now than it was back when I started. That being said, it shouldn't be dismissed completely. So my thinking was, well, let's just see who are some of the biggest year-to-year changers, risers and fallers in home run rate. And we can dig into this. And the hardest thing about this type of year-to-year analysis, of course, is coming off a 60-game season in 2020, there was more noise than ever just because we didn't get a full season's worth of innings from everybody. So you're going to have guys that were surprisingly good or surprisingly bad in 2020 who regressed back to their norm or closer to their norm in 2021. So those are going to be some of the players you
Dylan
see
Bundy.
Popping up. Yeah, right. Like Dylan Bundy popped up. But, you know, I ran the FanGraphs leaderboard on this. We've talked about this page, the season stat grid, year-to-year changes. I just set it from 2017 to 2021, popped in 20 innings pitched just to knock out a few of the guys that only threw a handful of innings. One of the first names that stood out to me is Adbert Alzolay. And I like him anyway, like regardless of what's going on with his home run, right? Just because there's a clear opportunity for him. He's shown improved control. That was the major skills gain for him, I think, compared to what he was doing, you know, in the upper levels of the minor leagues and even in his first couple tastes of Chicago. Big step forward from Alzolay in 2021. A 1.79 homers per nine. Like, that's a massive jump from where he was in the shortened season. And again, you go back and look at his minor league numbers. Didn't really have home run issues until 2019 at AAA. And if you've listened to this show for a little while, you know that 2019 at AAA, home runs hit there, total disaster, total chaos, right? They were using
the major league ball.
They were using the rabbit ball and the PCL, which Iowa, the Cubs affiliate, is a part of, even though it's not, you know, it's not Albuquerque, it's not one of the extreme hitter right. environments. The whole league
had to play there.
The whole league was a mess for home runs. There were hitters that had amazing seasons who actually weren't that amazing, and there were pitchers who got smashed that actually weren't that bad. And I think looking at the bigger picture, I'm not convinced that the home run issues we saw from Alzolay in 2021 are necessarily a reflection of his typical home run rate baseline.
Yeah. But there's a couple other things going on with Alzolay, which is that he added a cutter late in the second half. You know, if you look at when he added the cutter and you look at stuff and location, you see, oh my gosh, he had a 106 stuff plus from the time he added the cutter. The only word of caution I have there is that he also kind of went to like a multiple inning bullpen role at that point. And those two things are going to conflate your numbers a little bit because everyone's stuff looks better in two inning stints. But I would say that I think this is a guy who has above average stuff. I don't know if I'll go all the way to 106. I think this is a guy who has above average stuff, improved his command, and with now the cutter slider curve. I think he's just going to be a three breaking ball guy. He's shown the ability to spin it. He's always had strikeouts at every level. And those home runs that we've seen kind of go up and down have a little bit of a story to them in terms of, you know, the amount of sample, you know, his first real full year in the big leagues, you know, the rabbit ball in 2019. So I think he's a really intriguing arm. I don't know how far to push this one. I don't know if I want to give him the Eno stamp, and then all of a sudden people are taking him as the 30th best starting pitcher or whatever. I don't know if I go all the way Urquidy levels deep into this one. But I just got him an auto new mock draft that I'm doing for $2, and I put that kind of approval on him any day, any type of keeper situation. If you have, you know, back end starting pitching keeping, if you can acquire him. Just a generally an interesting arm. Draft and hold. I love him. Got him in my draft and hold in NFC. And would recommend as such for people.
Yeah. Elzola hasn't cracked the top 300 in a draft for the NFBC in the last 2 weeks or so. So if you're looking back through any draft that's held since November 20th, it's only a dozen drafts. The earliest he's been picked is like 320. So...
Let me see if I did that.
Yeah.
It's possible it wasn't me.
It's also not way off where he's been going overall. His range is fairly consistent. It's 326
to
443.
343.
Okay. So, yeah.
I took him 343.
The other pitchers near there, just to kind of paint a picture here, Nestor Cortez. I'm not sure about his role, even though what he did this season was, you know, good. Kyle Gibson. Yeah, no thanks. Mm-hmm. Not really interested in him. Taiwan Walker goes in that range. That seems reasonable. I think maybe you get more innings from Walker. It's going to be close. And Sixto Sanchez, health permitting, Ooh. Could be a nice bounce back candidate for sure in that same area.
I think draft and hold is just, it's a little difficult in draft and hold with the injuries. You're kind of trying to buy in innings. And so you can only take a shot on a couple guys with injuries, I feel like, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want to have that staff where like everyone's injured and you're not don't have enough innings. So a couple of interesting names in my draft that went after him was Eliezer Hernandez and Jameson Taillon. I absolutely think they belong in that conversation, and maybe we should have taken Eliezer Hernandez ahead. That's I stand on. I believe in Alzolay to that extent, and we chose to take him over Eliezer.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Got a question for you about Michael Kopech, just because we're talking about guys that have been between the two roles. Alzolay more time as a starter than Kopech in 2021. Ended up being 4 starts for Kopech. It was his first game action in years. Literally, last time he pitched for the White Sox was 2018. So a 3-year layoff, came back, pitched very well out of the pen. I know the Stuff Plus model loves Kopech. The home run rate we saw from him at the end of 2018, I mean, we're talking 14 and third innings, not really enough to read into that.
So long ago.
So, 1.17 homers per nine as a reliever in 2021. If we threw out his 2018 debut, that'd be the highest home run rate that Kopech had anywhere as a pro. So, even still, the question I have for you with Kopech is...
And with huge velocity like that, you wouldn't expect necessarily a home run rate problem.
Yeah, he's... He leaned really heavily on the fastball and slider, working in that mostly relief sort of role. They're going to give him a shot as a starter. He's pretty expensive compared to Alzolay. I mean, Kopech's like a fringe top 150 guy. ADP in that same span is about 165. Do you think when you start adjusting for having to work deeper into games, he wins a spot in the rotation, do you think this stuff holds up? Because it wasn't just, like, when you look at Kopech's past, he also had issues with walks, and that took a step in the right direction as a reliever as well, right? Just over 3 walks per 9, certainly not a problem there. I'm just trying to decide, like, how much can we bank on Kopech being a legitimately good starter based on what we saw from him in that mostly relief role for the White Sox? Because I'm pretty excited about him, looking at the core skills and seeing how much the stuff model likes him.
Yeah, it's interesting that we didn't get that many of his secondary pitches. You know, so that is kind of an open question. And then this velo is going to, of course, come down in multiple inning stretches. But I do really like that. It doesn't look like he has a big command problem. The stuff plus model, part of the reason why it likes him so much is because he did rely on the four seam and the slider. However, it's interesting to me that the stuff plus model likes his four seam better than a slider. So I think that he'll be able to handle a little loss in velocity. He really likes the movement of it. And the curveball is a 96 stuff plus 95 location pitch that ends up scoring as an average pitch. So I think he's going to be four-seam slider curveball with only the occasional changeup. And I think that's going to be the approach. And I think he'll still have a better stuff plus than Alzolay. You know, Kopech last year had a 115 stuff plus. And that's, he's just going to go down, and Alzolay's is going to go up. I think he has enough space there for regression to end up being a positive. I also see enough out of that curveball to like it and give him 3 pitches.
Yeah, if he's got 3 pitches consistently, thinking about the AL Central, you're going to use him much more than you're going to bench him, I would say, if he ends up in the rotation.
My main question is just how many innings can we give him? Steamer says 145, but that strikes me a little bit like the sort of Giancarlo Stanton will get 650 plate appearances projection, you know?
Well, I don't know. Kopech did 140 and 2/3 back in 2018.
It's true.
I mean,
he get injured.
Let's break it down this way. Let's say the curveball is inconsistent. He throws it enough to have 3 pitches, but it's inconsistent, and he's a pretty steady. He's 5 innings per start on average. Like, if that's where you want to go. Okay, 30 starts is 150 innings. Like, that's, so I don't know if I'd project him for 30, so maybe I'd go 26 or 28. And it's 130 or 140. So I think that 145, you know, coming from, I think it's the Fangraphs depth charts, that seems appropriate. And then it leads to a question: are you also comfortable drafting guys who are you're expecting 140 innings from in that 150 range when you're passing up on guys that don't have the workload concerns? Usually you're giving up ceiling to go for more innings. And, you know, names nearby: Ranger Suarez, Sonny Gray.
Ooh, see, I'd take Gray just because I feel like the stuff was still really good and the innings are more of a lock. But I'd take him, Kopech, over Suarez any day.
I'm not in on Suarez at all. Like, I'm...
Yeah. That choice was super easy. But I bet you if you listed more pitchers around where Kopech's going, I could find other pitchers I would take.
All right, I'll take that action. Luis Garcia?
Yeah, I think
you're
so.
You're Garcia over Kopech? Okay.
Yeah.
Going a little earlier, Stroman. Going Stroman over Kopech? I mean, innings. They probably have to. Down the other way for a couple more names. Oh, Kershaw? I mean... I don't know what to do with Kershaw.
I'll take Kopech over Kershaw, actually, because I think they're both, like, the question is innings, not talent.
I think the question is innings.
Kershaw right now is not even throwing.
The question is innings, and the key difference for me is that the Kershaw outcomes are closer to including a possible zero. Like any pitcher can blow out and get the zero.
I think the worst case scenario for Kopech is he's in the bullpen and he probably gives you pristine ratios.
Yeah, I mean, you're still a little salty about it if he's your 10th round pick, but you probably would hold on to him and say, yeah, I'll give it a few weeks and try to make it
through. Draft and hold, he'd still pitch you some weeks, right?
Mm-hmm. The other guys that are all clustered together, a couple other old guys, you got Adam Wainwright and Hyunjin Ryu, and then you've also got Tanner Houck. And I think the Houck situation is pretty similar to Kopech too, because we're expecting a lot more innings, and we're wondering, will the innings be as good in the expanded role? Totally fair question to ask.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why I take like Sonny and Stroman over him. But I would take Kopech over Houck and Kershaw, you know, over the innings questions, right? So
yeah, this is
I think he belongs in that group, but my personal the preferences would have some of the guys behind him ahead of him and so on and so forth.
So it sounds like more likely than not you'd get someone else that you like in that range and someone else would end up with Kopech. That's
I think so, but I mean, if I walked away with Sonny Gray and someone took Kopech in that same round, I wouldn't bat an eye.
All right, it's fair. Going back to the year over year changes to home run rate.
Oh yeah, that thing.
Yeah, that thing. Well, hey, we were talking about home run rate a lot.
Well, Bundy strikes me as a very interesting one because Bundy sort of went back to where he'd been. You know, he'd always had home run issues, and then they went away for a season. In 2020, he had a really good season, and then they came back. So I think there's just as much a possibility that Dylan Bundy just had one great season as there is that he's going to be better going forward.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that he could give them is 160 or 170 innings affordably. Like, that's the main thing they're probably looking for. I'm not expecting it to be a great turnaround. But I think it is, we talked about it a little bit on Friday, I think this is a good test for the Twins pitching. Like, we have kind of said, hey, it looked like they had a few pieces in place to take guys like this and make them pop. And last year was a kind of a step back. This might be one of the pitchers that group is largely judged on, the success of Dylan Bundy and trying to turn him back around and maybe split the difference, right? If you get him down to like a 1.3 home run rate, you can live with that if the walk rate comes back down. He has to have one of those things get better if he's going to be consistently effective in Minnesota.
There's a bit of a strange story told on his stuff page because I can't port it over to Brooks Baseball and tell you exactly what's going on. But Bundy, his slider has added more drop over the last 2 years, basically. But if you look at how much drop he's added and then you look at the stuff chart for his slider has just lost stuff consistently since the beginning of 2020 as it's been adding drop. So for some reason, in this case, the model does not like the fact that he's adding drop to his slider. And I think maybe because it's becoming more like his curve and maybe they're becoming more similar. But there's something needs to happen with that slider. I think maybe throwing it harder with a little bit less drop, more like a cutter. Remember Bundy was the whole thing where he was, you know, drafted as having this great cutter. And then the Orioles were like, it's not a cutter because we don't like cutters. Remember that?
Yes,
bit?
That was a lifetime ago almost. But yeah.
That's the thing that happened. So if he could maybe think cutter a little bit, maybe that'll work for him. I think that, you know, Bundy's somebody that I would probably have in that sort of 100 to 125 range where, you know, I take some shots in deeper leagues, maybe if they drop, but, you know, no way I'm putting him in my top 100.
I had him at
Alzolay will be in my top.
Bundy's 100. At 134, easily the lowest of the pitchers we've talked about so far, not ADP 134 starting pitcher ranking currently as, those continue to grind along in the background. Yu Darvish actually has a similar home run rate fluctuation to Bundy. That's not to say that they are in any other way the same, but I think what it is for me is it's a reminder that Darvish has always had trouble with home runs, and a big part of it for a while, you know, the old ballpark in Arlington, that was part of it. But even during his time with the Cubs, I mean, that's a pitcher-friendly environment. He had major home run issues there. And he can have success with that because the strikeout rate's as good as it is and the walk rate's been great. I thought Darvish was pretty consistently undervalued in some of the early drafts that I've seen. I'm wondering if maybe I'm a little too aggressive on that given the longer-term track record. Like, even in pitcher-friendly environments, he's had issues keeping the ball in the park. So I'm curious, where do you fall on Darvish as a possible, you know, early pitching bounce back candidate? This is a guy that was going in the second round of 2021 drafts, who's probably going to fall outside the top 75 overall more often than not here in 2022.
We went Sale Darvish in our drafting hold. But that was because, as you can probably tell from the names, we went light on starting pitching in the very early rounds. We went heavy hitting, ended up with like Trout and Betts in our first two picks, right? So Darvish, we got in the fifth at 73. So you're about right about where he stands. You know, we debated him or Musgrove, who went 77. That was the debate for us in terms of veteran starting pitcher. We might have taken Berrios, who went at 69, if he had dropped to us. So that was the conversation we were having. We thought it was a little bit early for the super young, like Alek Manoah, who went 75 right after us. So we did discuss him a little bit. So that's where I still have you, Darvish, obviously from that pick, as pretty high. We took him ahead of Luis Castillo even. I was happy to get him. I think that when you see that home run rate going up and down for you, Darvish, it's because of his command. But I could see him just having a good command season next year, and the stuff was still pretty decent. So that's, I'm just betting on a command bounce back with you, Darvish, basically. But he also stands, it's pretty funny, in that up and down cycle, he sits like just a few up from Andrew Haney. And I did a little bit of a different query when we were kind of preparing for the show, where I just looked at strikeout minus walks, and then I wanted to look at the high home run rates associated with that, and just basically saying, who could you bet on for strikeouts minus walks that maybe will regress their home run rate, you know, next season? The names that popped for me off this list were, number one was Eduardo Rodriguez, who was 22nd in strikeouts minus walks among, you know, starting pitchers, and had a 139 home run per nine. I think that'll regress, especially with the new park that he's pitching in. Another name that popped was Shane McClanahan with a 127. I don't know that he needs to have that high of a home run rate, especially calling Tampa Bay home. Andrew Haney, who we will forever bet that the home run rate is coming down, and someday we'll be right. You've got Blake Snell, who I think, you know, there was a little bit of an up and down in his pitch mix, and I think he found a better pitch mix near the end of the season. The last one I wanted to mention was Zach Gallen in the top 50 for K-minus BB and also owning a 1.3 homer per nine. So I like Zach Gallen for positive regression.
Yeah, there. Gallen, I've got him at 33 right now on my starting pitcher ranks, and puts him right around Stroman, Snell, who you mentioned, puts him a little behind. Actually, puts him behind Shane Baz, which is, talk about your tough ranks. We'll obviously have a tough ranks episode at some point between now and March. Like, what do you do with a guy that shows that?
Do I take the young veteran with some upside, or the guy who's all upside, who hasn't maybe hit his bad patch yet? Yeah.
Before publication, I could see Baz sinking a couple of spots, because it's one thing to make the list. It's another thing to follow through on it when you're on the clock and so, okay.
It's another thing to take Alek Manoah over. Yeah,
here we are. Shane Baz, my SP2 this season. Like, I don't know. I don't know if I want to go quite that far. I feel a lot better if he's a three or a four.
I'd feel so much better if I could get one of those guys as a three.
Yeah. Yeah, three is more realistic. Maybe in a 12-teamer, you could make him a four if you're pretty aggressive with pitching. Yeah, it's interesting that McClanahan had some home run issues. I don't think that's really going to be a part of who he is. The other pitcher that I had up near Darvish versus Charlie Morton ended up being the toss-up in the rankings. I think Morton is just consistently underrated. Their ADPs are almost identical. They're both going in that 85 to 90 range based on ADP. But Morton should be healthy for the start of spring training. And yeah, it's just, it's age. That's the only thing. That's the only thing about Charlie Morton that people, I think, could really quabble with, because he gets plenty of swings and misses. His stuff number's good. His location is good. He's not walking guys. He doesn't have a home run issue. Doesn't allow an overwhelming amount of contact in the zone, more than the guys ranked ahead of him for the most part. That's one of the areas where, you know, I use that conditional formatting when I'm looking at skills and kind of compare guys across the list. That's the one area where he's not quite like the other guys that I have in my top 20.
What in what way?
Zone contact rate. Now, he gets hit in the zone a little more than the other top 20 pitchers, but it's not, you know, it's not an alarming, you know, problem.
Uh-huh. I don't know. One thing that I like is that at his advanced age, 95.5 mm-hmm. still, you know, and that arrested a decline that was, I was worried was related to his shoulder issues, right? So pretty nice to see that velo number there.
Absolutely.
I'm in on him. You know, I even bought him in my auto new league. We're doing a mock and I bought him for like $19. You know, and I'm fully knowing, let me get the number exactly right. I paid $20 for Charlie Morton as my number two behind Garrett Cole. And fully knowing that, you know, I may only get 2 years of value out of that.
I traded for him in a keeper league before the keeper deadline because I felt like for a draft pick upgrade, it was a relatively small cost. I didn't have convincing keepers to up to the limit. So I said, you know what? I might be able to get an SP1 or a fringy SP1 in disguise in this 15-team league for a relatively small amount. I'm not that worried about long-term value if I'm trying to just either get someone I can trade later or
trying to compete now. He's a great, great player.
Yeah, I think in keeper and dynasty leagues especially, it's never going to cost you as much as it should to trade for him if he comes through and does what he's projected to do and sustains what he's been able to do over these last two seasons.
Yeah, no, I'm a fan. Then also just personally, he's just such an excellent person. I love how thoughtful he is.
Do you have a specific Charlie Morton anecdote to share? Anecdote?
I want to say the Astros just won it all. I'm not sure. Maybe it could have been an ALCS. My memory is not great. But I know for a fact that they're all celebrating. Everyone's smoking cigars and, you know, there's alcohol everywhere. Pretty sure they won it all. This is, you know, after they won it against the Dodgers. Yeah. They won it all. Everyone is celebrating, smiling, just running around the room, being a ridiculous person, you know, doing all sorts of selfies, you know, just over the moon. And Charlie Morton is crying. And he's just like in the corner crying. And I had been asking him about, I don't even know what, but it ended up being about his teammates. And he was just so proud of them and the feeling of camaraderie. And he was talking about the emotions of sharing this moment with all of them. And he was just crying. And, I don't know. It was like, that's Charlie Morton, baby. You know, still, you know, just the reason he started to cry was because of some question. He was trying to answer the question correctly and be honest and tell exactly how he felt. And at that moment, it meant that he was going to be crying instead of running around, you know, with a cigar in his mouth.
From a baseball perspective, too, his career has been a lot of peaks and valleys. Like, it took a lot for him to get to the point that he's reached in the back half of his career, just in terms of the injuries he's had to come back from. So I could totally understand that, just being very emotional in a situation like that.
I think, you know, one thing though is that with pitchers, like hard contact, even barrels allowed, ex-woba allowed, home run rate and stuff, you know, a fair amount of what we're looking at right now is just noise and regression and just saying these pitchers are good otherwise and their home run rate was high and, you know, we can expect a regression because of the statistical facts of the ball, of how the ball flies off a pitcher. That's not so much the difference in the two balls, right? Like, I think it would, like, I'm not saying necessarily Yu Darvish was throwing to harder, you know, he had the hard ball, right?
No, no,
you know? Like, but, you know, with hitters, it is interesting because there's usually a really tight relationship between your barrels and your home run rate. I think I just saw the relationship of barrels to home run rate, I don't know if it was the R squared or the correlation, but it was tight. It was like 0.75 or something. Even if that was just R, that's pretty good. So one thing I had a little aha moment was that you could treat isolated slugging percentage as a percentage. You know, when we look at it on the leaderboards, it's usually 0.205 or something, right? Not listed as percentage. But what ISO is, another way of saying ISO is your extra base hit rate. That's what it is. Because what you take is you take basically slugging and you subtract average out of it. So it's basically your rate of X-rays hits. So if you start looking at ISO as a rate of X-rays hits, and then you look at barrel rate, now you have two things to subtract from each other that are on the same scale. And when you have a large difference between them, it means that probably you overdid your barrels a little bit. And if you have a small difference between them, it means that you didn't get as much out of your barrels as other people. But quickly, when I did the query, I realized that you have to do a little bit more work on top of that, because the number one, the person with the smallest difference between his ISO percentage and his barrel percentage was Jake Bowers, who had a 5% barrel rate and had an ISO of 0.067. The problem is that 5% barrel rate is also not good. So even if he plays to his barrel rate next year and has like a 0.100 ISO, like, so what?
Bench player, you know.
still a problem for him. Still needs to hit the ball harder. So instead, what I did was, okay, who is near the bottom in the difference between ISO and barrel rate, and also has a good barrel rate, mm-hmm. right? So the interesting names are Bradley Zimmer, who has the third smallest difference and had a 9.4% barrel rate. And then Trevor Larnach pops in this. But then if you set the cutoff at 10%, the names really pop for me, which are Nico Goodrum, Bobby Dalbec, Andrew Vaughn, Tommy Pham, and Josh Donaldson. With a little bit of Rowdy Tellez. Gotta get a mention in for Rowdy Tellez and Matt Chapman there at the end. I mean, for the most part, I think I like all those guys to have better power going forward.
Yeah, so that group, it's got a good mix of players, because you've got the younger guys, you've got the former prospect in Zimmer who's just really struggled to stay healthy, you've got a couple of older guys where Donaldson and Pham, you look at those two guys, and they both Donaldson and Pham, they pop into my head when you bring up that there's a greater likelihood of a projection failing you with an older player, right? Like when you go down that road, they're the kinds of guys I think of, mostly because of health, because of Donaldson, right? I mean, that's a big part of it. Like the projections come out really good. People know, yeah, well, I mean, Donaldson's way past 30. Pham, I think, is a little bit younger than that. So you look at Pham and you say, is he going to run as much as he's always run? You know, is he, where's he going to go? Where's he going to end up playing? Donaldson, how many games are you going to get? Like those questions pop up. But I like that you have this thing where you've caught some young players. Andrew Vaughn, I think, had a good rookie year. I think it's so important to remember the context for a guy that was coming through the minors the way he did, right? A college bat who didn't get a 2020, who made the leap essentially from high A at the end of 2019 to the big leagues, learned a new position, and didn't fall on his face. A 94 WRC plus, yeah, okay, that's not a great season compared to just guys that have been in the big leagues for a while, but for a first-time big leaguer in those circumstances,
sort of thrust into baseball maybe a little bit earlier than...
Kind of happy with it. If the AAA season had started on time, they might have sent Vaughn down to AAA to begin the year and let him spend the first few weeks or the first month there.
And he really could have benefited from a 2020 minor league season.
But I think he held his own, and the underlying numbers are good, right? The K rate, for 21.5% K rate for a guy making a three-level leap, that's huge.
That's the big separator, I think, between these names. If you're wondering, well, you know, some of these, you know, Bobby Dalbec already had power. How can he have more or whatever? If you then say, I'm more interested in guys who don't strike out 30% of the time, then you remove Goodrum and Dalbec from this list, and Vaughn becomes, you know, one of five, basically, you know, and the youngest. So, you know, I would bet, just statistically, I'd bet on these. You're right to bring up the age on Donaldson. That's a big question mark. But he's also falling in drafts, and someone that I find really intriguing and more interesting almost as his price falls. I want to get because we had a debate. I'm co-managing this, and we had a debate, and we didn't get him. He went in the 17th round at 255 in this draft and hold, And I was a little disappointed he didn't go to us. I think he went like right before us, or we were thinking about something else for some reason and didn't take him. What did we take? What is our name in this?
I'm kind of enjoying this sleuthing process.
What is it? Who are we? He must have changed our name. Oh man, I can't find us. Who did we take?
Donaldson never goes too early at this point in his career. Never. Like I've not been in a draft in years where Josh Donaldson was drafted and I said, well, that was too early. Like I think people have
we didn't have a catcher, and so we took Mitch Garver because we didn't have a single catcher.
I think the only category with Donaldson that you know is just pretty much mediocre or possibly bad is batting average. Like you're not getting a great average from him at this point. Even though the K rate's not bad, I think in leagues where you use OBP, you get a bump because he's always drawn walks and he's still, you know, 13%+. I think 13% was his lowest walk rate since 2015. What's pretty amazing. And I think the other thing that works in Donaldson's favor is that even though you have that added injury risk because of the recurring calf issues and other ailments that kind of pile up on a guy who's now, yeah, he's going to be 36 in a couple of days. When he's healthy, he rarely gets days off. He's still closer to a max volume plate appearance sort of guy for the time that he's available. And basically, it's just a longer way of saying he's never going to be a platoon guy. Like, I don't think that's the case at all. Like, when healthy, if they've got 7 games in a week, he's starting at least 6 of them, and maybe all 7 if he's had a day off somewhat recently. So I like him.
Yeah, he's more of a load management guy. He's like LeBron at this point, where you're just like, he's going to be good when he's in. I like him a little better in daily lineups, but I'll still take him in weekly because I think he'll be useful. Really interestingly, he went in a round that included Bobby Dalbec. And also a name that's sort of on my query doesn't quite make the barrel rate. I think because he had a 9.5% barrel rate, but Nate Lowe, 25% strikeout rate, nearly a 10% barrel rate, and a poor ISO given that barrel rate. So. Nate Lowe is and he went in that same round. Nate Lowe is somebody that's showing up on my teams.
So Matt Chapman was on that list too. He goes a bit earlier.
He goes in that, yeah, he's right there by Nate Lowe.
Chapman, we don't know where he's going to play next season because it seems like there's a good chance he gets traded. But if they're going to trade only one of Olsen and Chapman, it seems like it makes more sense to trade Olsen, given that Chapman could still be an elite defender and possibly bounce back and bring you more in a trade later on. Fringy for the top 200 in terms of ADP. I'm in on that all day, because I think even though we're talking about a guy that did have it was a hip surgery, I think is what it was, going out of 2020, yeah. He will play every single day possible. Like, it's kind of like the Arenado playing time. Like Donaldson, there is legitimate batting average concern, probably worse, much worse because of the K rate.
Getting beat on high fastballs pretty badly. But I feel like there's got to be an adjustment he can make.
Though. 18 and 19, like even if the 36 homers because of the rabbit ball is something he can't do again, high 20s seems very attainable, and it's with good counting stats. And I think we've seen the floor with his batting average. I think the K rate's going to go back closer to what we saw pre-2020 from Matt Chapman, and there's a very good chance that with a trade, if he does get traded, he's ending up in a better lineup and in a better park too, so that could also give him a pretty nice boost.
A's 25th by home run park factor on Baseball Savant. Yeah. So unless he goes to, I guess that there's a risk he could go to the Cardinals or Giants, but
he's not, he won't go to the Cardinals.
Yeah, he won't go to the Cardinals, yeah. And I kind of doubt he'll go to the Giants.
If he went to the Giants, though, but I would have a lot more confidence in his high fastball issue being fixed, given the successes they've had.
Yeah. And also, the lineup, they managed to score a bunch of runs, so he'll at least have people on base and, you know. But there's also 24 other teams where he would have a better park for his home run.
Yeah, Rowdy being on this list is interesting only because I don't know if the Brewers are going to make some kind of trade and end up with a first baseman that way, or if they'll, you know, get a bargain free agent.
It was a little disappointing to see his defense.
It is a concern.
I remember very clearly a couple moments in the series against the Braves where I was like, oh, that's your range. there was a ball that was like maybe 3 or 4 feet away from him, and he like fell down trying to get it. And he just, you know, his range is his body to the left and the right.
Yeah. Like those old, I don't know if anyone's ever played with, like, there was this this table soccer game that my grandparents had when I was a kid, and the goalie had a button to dive left and a button to dive right, and he was on like a little metal wire, so if you want to try and make a save, you could fall over to the left or you could fall over to the right.
Yeah, he wasn't going to jump off of his mooring. Like, he's just going to fall down to the left.
If the shot was in a corner, he wasn't quite tall enough with his arms outstretched to stop it. So if a well-placed shot happened, he couldn't get there. And that's...
But he could fall down to the left. But he could fall left and right. That's Rowdy Tellez, baby.
I got to find a picture for a visual. Fun game. Kind of wish I still had something like that. The last name from that list, I mean, Larnach's interesting, Dahlbeck's interesting for their own reasons. I think we've talked about at least Dahlbeck in the not-so-distant past. But Bradley Zimmer is basically free. His team is super cheap because they're not going to spend any more than they have to. They did go bargain shopping. They had Eddie Rosario last year. That didn't work out. But I just think it's at this point... 35% K rate for a guy that's now 29 years old. I'm worried that he's just not going to fix that enough, even though there are tools. 15 steals, too. 15 for 18. I remember Ian Kahn a few times on the Under the Radar show throughout the year was saying, yeah, I'm interested. He's playing. He's running a bit. He's still got some power. And I think it was more for deeper leagues. I want to say it was more for like AL labor and maybe 15 teamers on and off the roster sort of guy, depending on the schedule. Have we seen enough of Zimmer to say this is who he is when we're talking about a guy who's this old? Or can we look at it and say, actually, he doesn't even have 1,000 big league plate appearances yet because of all the injuries. So why would we assume this is who he is if that's how we want to grade players' skills over time?
Yeah, it's tough. The one thing I would say is that the fairly constant, the thing that's been there his whole career and that is believable in small samples anyway, is the strikeout rate. So I think even if he's good, he's going to strike out a lot. But he could have a good season where, you know, he walks 10% of the time, strikes out 35% of the time, has like a 250 ISO. I mean, his barrel rate suggests that he could have a higher ISO. You know, his barrel rate last year was 9.4%. That's good. 10% is good. So if he had like a 200 ISO even, you know, then he would probably be an above average bat given the patience. And then his defense is going to make him good. I don't think he's going to take Straw's job. So the good news for him is that the Guardians don't have any other outfielders either. So I mean, they've got Josh Naylor coming back from huge injury. And then I think for the two other spots other than Straw, what you're seeing is a battle between Brad Zimmer, the ascendant Nolan Jones, the recovering Josh Naylor, Stephen Kwan, who I think we've talked about on the show before, but is really good in terms of doesn't strike out and walks a lot. We'll have to see what his batted ball rates look like. And then the sort of recovering Oscar Mercado. So Zimmer could absolutely beat out any one of those.
Also, when I look at the Guardians depth chart, I want them to just play Josh Naylor at first base. Josh Naylor's a first baseman. Play him at first. Just let that happen.
I mean, it's awful to me that they were playing Yu Chang there. I mean, just awful. You know? And, you know, Jake Bowers was also awful for them. And then Bobby Bradley is more of a DH type, I think. And, I mean, he projects as a worse bat than Naylor. So I think I agree with you. I would put Bradley and Naylor in a competition.
I would expect Naylor to ultimately win that. I know I'm getting a little too excited about a guy that's got a career 87 WRC plus, but he doesn't strike out, does show flashes of power. Put him in his natural position.
Bradley reminds me of the old Chris Carter types almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when you're striking out 36% of the time, you don't have defensive value and you don't really have a great walk rate, then you're closing in on Chris Carter.
Yeah, I'm not seeing any more than that coming from Bobby Bradley. So I do think if you're trying to figure out where outfield playing time goes, you could reasonably say Josh Naylor's going to play first base this year and he's not part of that outfield rotation.
And Nolan Jones has to come up and start his clock, which they may not want to do because he's striking out a lot anyway in the minor league. So the opening day outfield might be Zimmer, Strom, Mercado, just for sort of playing time, like service time type reasons. You know?
Yeah, and I could see Mercado ending up being more the fourth outfielder and small side platooning with Zimmer and then serving as maybe like a backup center fielder if Straw's unavailable, and then they go some old veteran, some cheap old veteran. I would have said a Cole Calhoun type, but Texas got him already, so some guy like that.
Yeah, they could add a cheap veteran to that and make it a foursome. Then the next round of cuts and drops will be Zimmer and Mercado, right? Like I think sometime this next season, if Zimmer and Mercado aren't any better, their roles will be cemented as something other than a starter. Yeah.
No, I think that's...
Am I being too pessimistic about Mercado? Did he have a bit of a bounce back last year?
I mean, a slight bounce back. His 2020...
Oh, he was still 15% worse than league average.
His 2020 was just awful. But the K rate came back down. He walked more than he walked upon arrival.
That's right. But the power is not really there.
No, I mean, it does look like a 12 to 15 homer, 15 steal guy that doesn't get on base a ton. So
enough to keep
or
the
at
job,
least not enough to be a leadoff guy, right? If he's like a 330 OBP guy, is that going to be enough for them to lead him off, or is he going to be a 6-7 hitter? I think it's probably the latter. And man, he's a little older than I thought too. He's already going to be 27 in just a couple of weeks. So
I think it's basically pooper get off the potty time for Zimmer and Mercado this year.
Two.
And they'll start moving other guys in.
Two behind. References to the bathroom. Let's get one.
It's not to a counter. My life, the bathroom figures high in it. I've got two little boys. They can't hit the target.
Let's get to a couple of possibly overlooked Padres moves. We didn't talk about these in all the transactions that happened last week. Let's start with the addition of Nick Martinez. He goes to the Padres.
Former Ranger. Yeah. No way. To the Padres?
That
a Ranger?
Never happens. I think the deal is 4 years and $20 million, but if I remember correctly, there's an opt-out after the first year. So if he's really good, then, you know, onward and upward. Anyway.
God, they couldn't just get him. Like, they gave him $20 million. They couldn't just get him.
He's actually opted out after 2022 and 2023. Okay, so
guy has a career 4.77 ERA in America. He's 31, and they gave him an opt out.
But
anyway, I'm sorry, I was being more negative. I like him a little. So.
Yeah, how do you think he fits in terms of role? How likely is it that he is beginning the year as a starter, and where do you start to go in terms of your expectations value wise for him?
So I will have to give Sung Min Kim a shout out here. Sung Min Kim here. He had a thread on him that I'm going to rely on mostly for my analysis on here, because Nick Martinez was in Japan. And so apparently he pushed his fastball velocity up to 93.
Okay.
Last year. So he was 90 poo when he left, but 93 is above average velo, or at least average velo. And then he also added a Vulcan change that has become his out pitch.
Joining the John Gant Club.
Uh-huh. And I always think of Kyle Loesch. these are not the best comps you've ever heard in the world. No, but I think he can at least be a fifth starter. And if that Vulcan change actually has some good swinging strike ability to it, and he's 93, you know, he could be an interesting, like, I don't think I can put him in the top 100 based on this information, but in that 100 to 120 range where you're taking shots. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, he's...
I mean, what does the Padres depth chart look like right now?
He's probably got a inside track to the fifth starter spot initially, but then anytime someone looks good or is ready, he could be the first guy to accommodate them. I mean, Musgrove, Darvish, Snell, obviously safely in. The variable, I think, in the beginning of the year is too, is when? Clevinger, if he's 100% good to go, which I think
when is he, ready?
He could be. And then Chris Paddock, I started this early draft season excited about Paddock, and then he got the elbow injection. He's got a slight UCL Dennis tear. I don't know. Like I never feel good about that injection being the be-all, end-all, and Paddock has work to do anyway. And I think that's part of the problem. Even if the injection works and keeps him healthy, it's keeping him from getting a third pitch that he's comfortable with this offseason. Then he still has the same flaw that he's had.
How much pitch design time does he have this offseason?
So that's part of the issue. So I'm pretty pessimistic on Paddock right now after really thinking I was going to have a lot of Paddock. I've even got him on a couple of teams, but I probably won't get him much more, at least until the late part of draft season, once we get some kind of look at him in spring and maybe if things are going well. All that's to say, Musgrove, Darvish, Snell, Clevinger's probably good to go. And then what do they do with Dinelson Lamet? I mean, we went through this last draft season too. I don't know if you can rely on him as anything more than a part-time starter.
Put him in the pen, yeah. I think they'll put him in the pen. I think they have a need in the pen, first of all. And then second of all, he just seemed injured. His stuff number was way down. And if he didn't, like out of the mound, he didn't really inspire much confidence. So, you know, without him, they still have the five. It'd be interesting to see if they try to keep him a little bit stretched out and he's middle relief, or they try to keep him doing two or three innings, because the depth behind Nick Martinez, if Paddock is actually hurt, Weathers and Gore are the next ones, and then you're waiting on Morahan to come back. So it actually gets pretty dicey back there. Like, you may need Lamet as your six or seven starter, because Weathers needs to kind of do an overhaul on his pitch mix to get back. He needs to go to a sinker-based approach and probably change his slider. Gore is maybe in the middle of that overhaul, and maybe he's more ready than he has been in the past, so maybe Gore can be your six. But then then Lamet needs to be your seven, at least until Morahan or Paddock show better health, you know? So if there's a way that they can kind of... not make the decision on Lamet as long as possible, I think that's what they'll do.
Let's talk about the reliever addition the Padres made. Luis Garcia, who most recently pitched for the Cardinals in 2021 and pitched well. He had a couple of saves even late in the year, 3.24 ERA, 0.99 whip, 34 Ks and 33 and a third innings. He got a 2-year, $7 million deal, and the Padres are on that pretty long list of teams where you'd say, who's the closer, or at least who's the main closer if they want to go the committee route? It's, to me, just as likely to be Garcia as it is to be anybody else. I mean, I think the few things that I take into consideration when trying to project or guess at these things is past experience as a closer, which I think matters less and less to teams now, year over year, than it ever has. Money, how much money are they paying someone? And then maybe stuff, like in terms of, you know, lefty-righty splits. But even still, you might have a team that says, yeah, that's our best reliever, so he's coming in the seventh here, he's coming in the eighth here, and today he's getting a save. I don't know if the Padres are going down that path. The Mariners, we talked about last week, they seem to be going down that path. So are you looking at any of the current relievers, either Garcia, Pomeranz, Pagan, anybody else they've got, and saying, yeah, I actually think that guy is going to get most of the saves in San Diego?
I think it's Luis Garcia. You know, Drew Pomeranz is coming back from a surgery, and I don't think that we have necessarily more information. He had the surgery on August 14th. You know, there's different ideas about how long, you know, maybe he should be ready to begin the season. But even then, he is a left-hander, which teams go to him. We go to left-handers a little bit less often than you'd expect as in the closer role. And then on top of that, I think at this point it is fair to say that the team has chosen other options over Pomeranz a couple times now, signing Melanson to close over him. So I think this I I look back at that Melanson signing and say, they signed a guy. They had Pomerantz in the fold, and they signed a guy, and that guy closed. So there is not really like a this guy has experience in that pen. There's not, like, we're talking about this. There's not a lot of saves on the back of the baseball cards in this pen. But Luis Garcia changed from throwing a four seam that he couldn't command to throwing that sinker more often in St. Louis, and I think that was perfect. I think that brought it all together, and that made him a closer-level arm, honestly. So I it's all Luis Garcia for me.
Yeah, basically was free in draft and holds. Probably still not going to jump up a ton without some sort of official announcement. So I think there is an opportunity there, and worst case, for draft and hold, we're going to do a separate episode at some point. Just talking about strategy, roster construction, you can live with a few short relievers who aren't closers because you're going to have weeks where you don't have enough starters available anyway, and you just want somebody out there who's going to help with the ratios, maybe steal a win. San Diego should be good. He should be effective regardless of role, so I do think Luis Garcia is pretty easily draftable in San Diego, even without any sort of confirmation of role.
Yeah, if there's some news in spring where, like, Pomerantz is healthy and stuff, and Luis Garcia's stock starts going down, I think he becomes even more. So I think he'll be really affordable now, and then over the course of the offseason, people will be like, ooh, Luis Garcia, like him. He'll go up. Pomerantz news, go back down, hopefully, and there'll be another buying cycle for Luis Garcia. But I'm not going to put him, you know, I think he's still in that back 10 of relievers, even if you kind of give him.
Yeah.
Like, would you put him in your top 20?
No. The earliest you could draft him, or where you could, like, kind of put him at the high end, you could put him in the Lucas Sims, Dylan Floro sort of range, where it's like, are they
pretty
the guys?
Sure they're the closer.
Yeah, like, probably the guy, and then maybe you put him ahead of those two guys because, like, the skills more, but...
I like him better than those two guys, yeah.
That's about where the line is. That puts him back in the top 25, and price right now, outside the top 500... Going to jump up, obviously going to shoot up probably 100, 150 picks.
You can't get him like we got him in our draft and hold.
Oh, you already have him? Unbelievable.
Yeah, I got him in my draft and hold. That's the other one. Nope. 738, baby.
738. There was a...
He was our last pick.
There was a 744 in there too. Someone else got him a little later than you did even.
We had it in the last pick, baby.
Well, hey, that could be a great last pick, which is why draft and hold is so fun, right? You take someone in round 50, and they end up having a significant role for you because you did it early. Something to pass the time, of course, during the great lockout of 2021 and 2022.
We're all going to be looking for something to do.
Like I said before, it's restraint for me. It's like... 50, 150 there, it starts to add up. So you just have to not go overboard.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to be careful. Because I think I want to do a main this year.
So. Are you doing a live one or are you doing one from home?
My first one, I don't know. I'm going to do one from
comforts
home.
Of home are sneakily underrated. I mean, not that, like, hanging out with a bunch of people that love, like, fantasy baseball is always fun, as we know from first pitch and everything. And
it's also just useful to have, like, I noticed this at AL Labor. I wish at AL Labor I had like three screens. You know what I mean?
I think
you want one screen that has like the draft up and what the other people in the draft are doing. You want one screen that has your numbers up, and you have one screen for like last minute, you know, searches or depth charts. Just have like a depth chart screen up.
This is why I use draft software. This is literally like the RotoWire draft software does all those things. That was not a planned commercial. They didn't pay for that. I worked there for a long time.
I don't use
it's as
it.
Much as I you can have in, on one software. Screen. Like, if you can't bring three screens, you need stuff that's quick within one. Mm-hmm. And you can be offline too, which I think was a bigger issue 10 years ago. I think everywhere you go now, you could pretty much get on some kind of network. But that's what I do. Just because, yeah, I want to have information ready just in case I need to check something out. And highly recommend you check that out if you want to be more organized with your drafts and auctions this year. But if you'd like to read what we have at The Athletic, 33% off the first year at theathletic.com/ratesandbarrels. Thanks to the many of you who signed up during the Black Friday Cyber Monday deal. You can find Eno on Twitter at EnoSaris. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. Drop us an email, ratesandbarrels@theathletic.com. That is going to do it for this episode of Rates and Barrels. We are back with you on Wednesday.
Thanks for listening.